Hey, good morning, everyone. Hope you're doing well. And today, again, as we've been doing, we're connecting various psukim in Mishlei to the events and to the stories of the Parsha. I have mentioned more than once that in Rabbeinu Bachaya, Rabbeinu Bachya, two pronunciations, famous commentary to the Torah, literally, in the introduction of each Parsha, what do they say? Let's see, treasure, blowing hot and cold. In the introduction to each Parsha, Rabbeinu Bachya begins every Parsha with a pasuk in Mishlei that he then expounds. Now obviously, since he follows the order of the Parshiot, he's not following the order of Mishlei, so in a sense I'm following Rabbeinu Bachya's model. And when it comes to Yosef, which really stretches across three parshios, really, Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, the story of Yosef. So let me give you the three verses that he uses, one verse for each parsha. The verse that he uses for Miketz, I'm going a little backwards, but I'm going in order of the book, is in Perek Gimel, Mishlei Perek Gimel, Pasuk He, Chapter 3, verse 5. B'tach el Hashem b'chol libecha. Have bitachon, have trust in God with all of your heart. V'yel binascha al tisha'en. And do not lean too much on your own understanding and your own ability to manipulate events. And this actually has kind of a double entendre, a double meaning as it applies to the Yosef story. First and foremost, it refers directly to the very, very difficult teaching of Chazal that Rashi brings, that the reason Yosef languished in prison for another 2 years until his dreams were told to Paro, not his dreams, until the Sar HaMashkim told Paro that Yosef interpreted his dreams, was because Yosef committed a great sin in asking the butler to intercede for him when he gets out, that Yosef should have had bitachon in Hashem. And on this, Rabbeinu Bachya applies the pasuk, you should trust in God with all of your heart and do not place faith in your manipulations, your strategies, and the like. Now, this is an extremely difficult chazal. This is not actually the subject for what we're going to talk about today, because after all, is there not a concept, and of course there is a concept, called hishtadlus? A person believes that Hashem is the source of their parnasa, but they have to go to work, usually. A person believes Hashem is the source of their refuah, if God forbid they are sick, but they are still obligated to get appropriate medical treatments. Judaism never takes the position that emuna negates the idea of seeking some practical strategy through which God's bracha will be manifest. So, if you simply look at the fact that Yosef is languishing in prison, and he asks the guy that's getting out because of Yosef's favorable interpretation of his dream, hey, can you put in a good word for me? Would we characterize that as a lack of bitachon or perfectly reasonable hishtadlus? You know, in modern Israeli society, we call that protexia, right? A person invokes protexia. We don't say lack of bitachon. So this is a very, very difficult chazal, actually, that Yosef should be punished because he asked the Sar HaMashkim, the butler, to intervene on his behalf. And the assumption has to be, as the Svarim HaKadoshim say, that the level of God's divine protection is commensurate with how much you have faith in it. Meaning to say, the less of a righteous person you are, the more hishtadlus you have to do. So a person who reaches a very, very high level of bitachon, the hishtadlus gets less and less and less and less, and consequently, back to the old idea that tzaddikim are judged by a higher standard, for Yosef to use the hishtadlus that would have been appropriate for any one of us, for him, it was a chet. It goes back to that idea that the tzaddik is held to a higher level. So that's one aspect of bitachon in Hashem. Yeah. Okay, that could be the, that could be an approach as well, that you're the one, you're the only one, you're the only mechanism. In fact, it's brought down that the way Hishtadlus works is Hishtadlus never has a direct cause and effect. So for example, if I go to work, I'm not making the money because of my work per se. Rather, going to work was my obligation and Hashem sent me a parnasa. Which is why sometimes you can do your Hishtadlus in one direction and then you'll win the lottery. So you may say, well, why did I take that job if I was going to win the lottery? The answer is no. You need it. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
But you had to buy a ticket.
You had to buy a ticket. Well, you had to have some money. Yeah, that's true. But the concept is, you have to do Hishtadlus. Now, the Hishtadlus could be something totally unrelated to where you got your money. It's never a direct cause and effect. In fact, my Rosh Hashiva, Rosh Shiller, the Rosh Hashiva Bar Sameach, tells me many, many stories where he works very, very hard to pursue leads for the yeshiva, for financial support, and sometimes he comes up dry. And then some surprise donation comes from the other side of the world. So he might think, well, that means all of my efforts were a waste. Not at all. You put your efforts, and then Hashem gives you a bracha, but it's not a direct cause and effect. It's not a logical cause and effect. So what you're saying makes sense. When you think your Yeshua will come specifically from that channel, that is a chisorin as well. Well, you know, that's a good point. A person shouldn't just describe himself as a tzaddik, but I think it's not so much of a self-conscious idea. It's not that, oh, I'm a tzaddik, and therefore. Rather, it's a question of the magnitude of your faith, that if you really have reached a level where you understand that everything is from God, then the Hishtadlus kind of vanishes. It's not a self-conscious, you know, labeling of yourself. Now, there's another aspect where this pasuk applies, and that is mitzad the brothers. The brothers wanted to get rid of Yosef, and I'll discuss why. They thought they would get him out of their lives. They would no longer be bothered by this kid of Rachel that was creating so much jealousy and enmity. They had a strategy. They had a bina. They had a plan. And what it basically says is, you know, your plans don't come to very much. Hashem has a way of getting his will done, not only in spite of your plan, but by using your very plan to achieve his particular goals. And that brings us to the other pasuk Rabbeinu Bechaya brings in Perek Yotes. This is a famous pasuk. It's I would sing it for you, but my voice is hoarse. It's also a beautiful nigun, an old nigun. It hasn't been sung for a while. But Perek Yotes, pasuk Chavalet, verse 19, chapter 19, verse 21. Rabos machshavos belevish v'yatsas Hashem Hitakon. Man has many, many thoughts. We have many plans, many strategies. We want to accomplish all sorts of things that we think are good for us. But ultimately, what's that, as the Yiddish paraphrase of it, a mensch tracht in gut lacht, and that's essentially the Yiddish paraphrase of this pasuk, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan that will supersede anything that we can think of. And that, of course, is the whole story of Mechiras Yosef. As Yosef said to his brothers, Atem chashavtem alai l'ra'ah. You thought to do evil to me. Elokim chashava l'tova. Hashem turned it into an instrument of good, not only for me, but good for you, and ultimately good for the Jewish people. Rabos machshavos, we have so many thoughts, and ultimately, Hashem's will prevail. Now, this is very extraordinary. In fact, this is philosophically an amazing proposition, because human beings have free will. So, in a sense, Hashem does not dictate any of our behaviors. So, the person who shoots somebody in a grocery store, you know, a criminal, Hashem didn't make him pull the trigger. This was his free will. So somehow, the trillions of decisions, and I think it is trillions of decisions, maybe more, quadrillions, I don't know, how many decisions human beings make every single day. And this is their decision, to serve Hashem or not to serve Hashem. And Hashem is not making them make that decision. But somehow, all of those decisions will be directed to achieve the goals, the ends that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has in mind. Which is quite phenomenal. Because how could a trillion decisions that God did not compel, that could have gone this way or that way, how can, no matter what happens, no matter what happens, it'll come out the way Hashem wants it to come out? It's like a chess game. You know, you have these grandmasters of chess that play 20 games at the same time. So like, no matter what your move, somehow they will be able to counter it to achieve what they want to achieve. Now, the chess master didn't make you move a particular place, but like whatever you move, you know, there's going to be a response that will get the champion to where the champion needs to go most of the time. Well, with Hashem, it's much more complicated than that, and it's also a higher percentage, namely 100%. But that's the Rabos Machshavos B'Levish, V'Yatzas Hashem, He Sokon. And that is really the epigraph of Mechiras Yosef, that no matter what you try to do. Of course, the story of Yonah, I mean, there are many examples, but the story of Yonah is another outstanding example. Yonah, the whole idea of Yonah, you know, he was given a prophecy to go to Nineveh and tell them that God is going to destroy them because of their evil ways. And he didn't want to do it. And it's not our subject, but the reason why he didn't want to do it, Chazal say, was because he knew they would do tshuva and God would have mercy on them. And the Jewish people don't always do tshuva, so he didn't want Nineveh to look better than the Jewish people. The Medrash actually says, Umo sa'olam krovim litshuva yoser mi Yisrael. That's what it means to be am kishei orev. We're a stiff-necked people. That's how we survive thousands of years of galus. That's why we die al kiddush Hashem. But that also means we're sometimes, being stubborn has its greatness, and being stubborn has its drawbacks. That sometimes we're not so easy to do tshuva. Umos ha'olam, less of a strength of character. No, they're threatened with something, they'll do tshuva right away. So Yonah didn't want to go. So what did Yonah do? He thought, it's hard to understand exactly what he thought he was doing. He wanted to run away. And figuratively, this is kind of, you know, we feel that way a lot too. You know, not that I'm going to physically run away, but you know, I just want to run away. You know, I don't want all this responsibility. I don't want all of these difficult decisions. And the story of Yonah is, you know, you can run, but you can't hide, to use another expression. That you can't run away from your mission. Hashem can employ even the craziest circumstance, like a fish swallowing you, to kind of bring you back to where you have to be. Remember a story I heard when I was teaching in law school years ago about a young fellow who didn't want to get up for school. So his mother said, you know, you got to go to school. And he said, I hate school, you know, they make fun of me, they criticize me, and all the kids, you know, look down at me. He says, I just don't want to go. So mom says, you have to go, you're the dean. So people run away from all sorts of responsibilities. Okay. Now the third pasuk, it's going backwards a little bit, is in Perek Yud Gimel. I'm sorry, Perek Yud Dalet. No? Yeah. I'll try to find it here. I'm sorry, Perek Tesvav 15, okay. Chapter 15, Pasuk Aleph. And that is actually the one that I want to focus the most on today. Manerach Yoshiv Chema. Right, 15:1. Ma ne'rach yoshiv chema, udvar etzev yaleaf. Again, a famous pasuk. A soft answer turns away anger. And Divrei Yatzev, an attacking answer, an answer that tries to be aggressive, Yala Af, will just bring up anger from the other side. Again, the simple meaning of the pasuk, I think, is pretty evident, and we see it as true all the time, that somebody's arguing at you, somebody's yelling at you, somebody's upset, and you are able to respond with calmness, with gentility, with kindness. Somehow that can diffuse the anger of the other side. If, on the other hand, pasuk aleph, yeah, perek tetzvav pasuk aleph. Yes, that's another pasuk, but yes, it's the same, a very similar idea. That you can diffuse. Now, this is very, very hard, because obviously if we're attacked, if somebody starts yelling at us or accusing us or is angry at us, and we feel it's not justified, even if we know it is justified, but we want to protect ourselves. So it is standard human nature, of course, that we return harsh words with harsh words. And then, of course, what happens is you're pouring gasoline on the fire, and it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And, you know, obviously this is not resolving anything. So Shlomo HaMelech says there is virtually a magic way of terminating machlokas. It may not be instantaneous, because a person has to have time to process it. But that's the manerach. The soft answer, the kind answer. And this has many components. Acknowledging that the person has something that's right. You know, you have a point. Maybe I didn't think about that. I mean, that sometimes confuses the person. Sometimes the person is so confused. Sometimes the person wants to fight. But, you know, this and that. And you say, yeah, you know, you're right. The person doesn't know what to do. Hey, I prepared to fight for an hour here, and I remember once, years ago, and I was staying in Rehavia, and one Sunday morning, there was a little fender bender. Somebody had hit the back of a car, and within 5 minutes, there were like 50 people outside who were discussing, arguing, yelling, who is at fault? So somebody said, well, let's call the police, you know, to straighten it out. He said, no, we haven't finished arguing yet. You know, they want to, there's a certain shiur that they want to argue without, and then they'll do what they have to do. It's kind of part of the process. Or they used to say in the old Arab shuks, you know, like in the old city. So the whole idea is to bargain, to haggle. So sometimes if you have a naive American, and the guy, the Arab, gives you the high price, and the American just says, sure. The Arab will sometimes says, I mean, actually, most of the time they'll take the money, you know, but today. But sometimes I've actually heard this. They'll say, you know, we're supposed to bargain, right? We're supposed to argue a little bit. You're not supposed to take the first price.
Why about the word etzev used? That is,
well, yeah, so etzev in biblical Hebrew is not always sadness. For example, the rather would be Chava. When Chava was cursed that childbirth would be painful, it says, be etzev tildi bonin. So etzev is not so much sadness as it is pain. So divrei etzev are words that are designed to hurt the other person. That hurtful words will bring up anger. Manerach will take away the anger, right? That's the contrast between manerach and divrei etzev. Now, the truth is, it's connected to sadness as well. Words that create pain, words that create sadness, it's all connected to that idea. Now, here, Rabbeinu Bachya says, this applies to the parsha we read yesterday, because that's essentially how Yehuda broke down Yosef's resistance, and we'll discuss this, and that is, when Yosef hears how much devotion Yehuda has for Binyamin, and Yehuda and all the brothers are willing to be slaves so that Binyamin shouldn't be alone there, Yosef breaks down. He says, that already I can't. And that's manerach. Yosef had a lot of chema, Rabbeinu Bachya says. Look at what his brothers did to him. But Yehuda came up with, not knowing it was Yosef yet, but Yehuda was the manerach. Manerach, yoshiv, chema, And that explains why Yosef finally revealed himself. So you see all of these different verses. One is the Rabos Machshavos. Man's thoughts are many, but God's plan comes true no matter what. B'tachel Hashem, that Yosef should have put all of his bitachon in Hashem, and he did not, and that resulted in a punishment. And finally, in Parshas Vayigash, Manerach Yoshev Chema, that it was Yehuda's soft answer, which expressed both love and regret and remorse and care, that took away whatever Chema Yosef had.
Where do we see that it's so rach?
Huh? Well, the truth of the matter is, Chazal make it much tougher than the Psukim. The Psukim itself is a maner rach, because in the maner rach, he's speaking rach in the sense of acknowledging that Binyamin was beloved to the father, etc. In other words, overcoming the jealousy that they had. So here, I want to talk in a more general way, because, you know, this Tuesday, we have a Tainus, we have a Sorah B'Teves, the first of the Tanaisim that commemorate or that remember the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. It's only the first Beis HaMikdash, because Asarah B'Teves is actually the earliest in the historical cycle. This is when the Babylonians began the siege against Jerusalem. So in terms of history, this was the first event in the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Interestingly enough, Asarah B'Teves, see, Tisha B'Av, of course, both connects the Bayis Rishon and the Bayis Sheni, because both temples were destroyed on the same day. The 17th of Tammuz also has a connection to the Bayis Rishon and the Bayis Sheni, because on Tammuz and the Bayis Rishon, although it was the 9th of Tammuz, but in the month of Tammuz is when Yerushalayim was broken into. And in the second temple, it was also broken into on the 17th. But Asarah B'Teves has no shaychus at all to the Bayis Sheni. It is only connected to the Bayis Rishon. That is true. But what's interesting is, Rav Shlomo Fisher, who's a great Talmud Chacham, said something, and it's interesting that he just said it. I mean, he doesn't give a makor. It's quite unusual for him to make this makor. But he says, Libi Omerli, that Asarah B'Teves was the day that the brothers sold Yosef. Now, again, he doesn't bring much of a proof to this, so I can't consider it an authoritative teaching. But he makes this point. You find that each of the Tanaisim about the Beis HaMikdash is connected to some primeval, almost original sin that we committed. So, for example, the chait of the Meraglim is what was goreng Tisha B'Av, because the Meraglim came back on the 8th of Av and the people cried the 9th of Av. So Tisha B'Av is connected to the chait HaMeraglim. Shiva Asor B'Tamuz was the day that Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai and broke the Luchais because of the chait HaEgel. So Tisha B'Av has its roots in the Meraglim. Shiva Asar B'Tamuz has its roots in the Chet HaEgel. Asarah B'Teves has its roots in Mechiras Yosef, because those are the three big Averis. So as a result, it actually makes sense, in a sense, because if the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam, so the connection of Asarah B'Teves to the Bayit Sheni is via Mechiras Yosef, which was Sinas Chinam. So although the historical event of the 10th of Teves is Mechubar to the Bayis Rishon, if you posit it is connected to Mechiras Yosef, that would make it a root and a shayrish of the Bayis Sheni as well. Now, we know that the whole story of Yosef is very, very perplexing on so many levels. All of Chumash Bereishis is so difficult in terms of family relationships. We have these questions over and over and over again every year, whether it's Cain and Hevel, whether it's Noach and Chum, whether it's Yaakov and Esav. Abraham and Ishmael, the different ways that Yaakov dealt with his different wives, over and over again, all of these difficulties of how families work out, and these are the eternal questions that we never have full answers for, so I'm not going to give you a full answer today either. But Yosef and his brothers is, you know, kind of the end of Sefer Bereishis, and it hits us once again with all sorts of questions, really on both sides of the equation. How could Yosef's brothers do what they did? Aye, they were jealous. Aye, there was favoritism. Okay, but is that what a brother does to a brother? I mean, and we believe the Shvatim were tzaddikim and were righteous and the founders of Am Yisrael. Even a person who's not a tzaddik doesn't behave that way. How could they possibly do what they did? And then we saw Yosef. Yosef was separated from Yaakov for 22 years. Why didn't he attempt to contact his father during those 22 years? Would that have been impossible? Would that not have been shayach? Okay, good. There was no email. There was no fax. But, you know, there was communication. Canaan is not unusually far from Mitzrayim. People did go back and forth, just as the brothers went back and forth. And then, why does Yosef act towards his brother? Now, we understand, from a humanistic standpoint, we understand why Yosef would be angry and upset. I'm not questioning, you know, that approach, although some people don't even like to bring in the human emotions, but okay, I think it's legitimate. But why is he so insistent that Binyamin be brought to him? Knowing how much pain that's going to cause Yaakov. And finally, what's the point of this frame-up of Binyamin, where he puts his gavia, he puts his cup, in Binyamin's sack? Binyamin was not someone who did anything for Binyamin was not involved in the Bechira. Binyamin was beloved to Yosef. So we have all of these different questions, both mitzad, why the brothers did what they did, and mitzad Yosef's reaction. Now, mitzad the brothers, we do have an illuminating comment of the Sephorno. The Sephorno says the following. The Pasuk says that Yosef brings Lashon Hara about his brothers to the father. Let's assume that it was true, and there are various halachic justifications for both sides of this. The brothers see a certain pattern that's being replicated. Abraham had a son, two sons, Yishmael and Yitzchak. Yishmael gets excluded, and Yitzchak becomes the bearer of the covenant. Yitzchak has two sons, Yaakov and Esav. And once again, Esav gets excluded, and Yaakov becomes the bearer of the covenant that Hashem made with Abraham. Now, Yaakov has two main wives plus two maidservants, Rachel and Leah. Yaakov loves Rachel more than Leah. Yaakov shows favoritism to the child of Rachel more than Leah. And now Yosef is discrediting those brothers in the eyes of their father. They see Yosef as trying to orchestrate their exclusion from the bris, so that the destiny of the Jewish people will be fulfilled exclusively through the children of Rachel and not through the children of Leah. Now, this does not just affect them as individuals. This affects their spiritual destiny to the end of time, their children, their children's children. As a result, the Sephorno said, the brothers concluded that Yosef had the status of a rodef. A rodef is somebody who wants to kill me. And the halacha is, if it's necessary to remove him by killing him, that he shouldn't be a danger to me, I am allowed to do so. And therefore the brothers convened a base in declaring that Yosef was a rodef, because if one who threatens my body can be eliminated as a threat, one who is threatening my very spiritual existence until the end of time is an absolute satana. And therefore they paskened that Yosef was chayav misa. Now even Yehuda, who eventually said, let's sell him as a slave. That simply reflects the halacha that even by a rodef, if you can eliminate the threat without killing him, you're mechoyev to take the lesser step. So Yehuda's argument was, we can get rid of his threat by selling him, and therefore we don't have a hetter to kill him. So this is such a strong argument that one wonders, so why is Mechiras Yosef a sin? Weren't the brothers right? Didn't they have the right to do what they did? But the short answer is that Hashem judges particularly the righteous not only by the propriety of their action, but by their motivations, which may be subconscious and not even within their awareness. And that is, yes, they had a very elaborate halachic structure that justified what they did, but deep inside, there was jealousy, there was envy, there was even certain elements of hatred, which Yosef admittedly fanned by telling him all of his dreams, etc. And therefore, Hashem said, don't make believe that you acted objectively because of halachic principles. There was much animosity there. And that is the idea in life, that we often can justify our actions by pointing to good reasons, when in fact those good reasons were not our real reasons. Our real reasons were things that were not so good. In fact, if you look at the Holocaust, it's very, very fascinating in some ways that the Holocaust had a legal structure. It's quite amazing. I mean, you might figure, if you're a barbaric society that's just going to murder 6 million people, you don't need to have laws and regulations and court opinions. You're just going around murdering people. A terrorist doesn't like. But Nazi Germany, it's very interesting, had a very there is a law of the Holocaust, meaning there were procedures, there were records, there were regulations, there were standards that had to be kept in murdering people. And this is so bizarre. What type of laws are you having? But that gave them the pretense. This was a psychological, it's hard for us to understand, and I don't expect you to fully understand this. But somehow, if it becomes part of a legal process, just like, you execute a criminal, whatever it would be, it's not so bad. We're not barbarians. We're not just murderers. We have laws, we have procedures, we have judges, we have courts, we have regulations, thousands of pages of regulations. There is like a legal structure to the destruction of Jews in the concentration camps. Amazing, amazing. This is an example of how we create, Baruch Hashem, I don't mean to compare what we do to that, but this is how we create structures to kind of normalize, justify, rationalize what we're doing, when in fact it is base animal impulse that is driving. So that's the problem with the brothers. But now, let's switch it to Yosef. How do you explain Yosef's reaction? Now again, if you just look at this from a secular standpoint, you could say Yosef is angry, Yosef wants to hurt his brothers, but even if you go with that position, which is not the way we commonly go, why doesn't he contact Yaakov? Yaakov is his father. So there are a few explanations that are given. The Mefarshim asked the kasha, why didn't Yosef contact Yaakov for those years? One explanation is that it would have been dangerous to contact Yaakov because perhaps Yosef himself would have been accused of being a spy, that somehow he is communicating with another nation. It's hard to understand that because as far as the Chumash is concerned, Mitzrayim and Canaan do not seem to be in a state of hostility at that time. So I'm not sure why it would have been perceived as dangerous to Yosef. Another commentary, a modern person from Gush Etzion, says the following. This is quite amazing, but I think it's Keneged Chazal. He says that Yosef did not want to contact Yaakov because he thought Yaakov was in on it. Yaakov himself rejected him. Because, after all, Yosef was sent by Yaakov to seek the welfare of his brothers. And then he gets sold. Yosef actually thought that Yaakov rejected him. I mean, imagine the pain that Yosef felt. If you assume that, the whole pain of Mechiras Yosef becomes magnified to an infinite degree, because Yosef feels he no longer has his father on his side. Now, I think that's a little schwer. I think that's a little difficult, because we all know the famous Chazal that Rashi brings, that when Yosef is tempted by Potiphar's wife, and he's on the verge, we don't realize he is on the verge of being Nichshal, it is the image, right? Musti Yukno, it is the image of his father, that he remembers his father, and that stopped him from doing the sin. Now, it seems to me that if he felt his father had rejected him, I'm not sure if he would summon up the Musti Yukno. But maybe he still would. Again, I don't say it's a proof against it. It still may be he remembers the olden days. But I think it's more mistaken that he still knew that Yaakov loved him and cared about him and the like. A third shot would be this. Remember, Rashi says, why was Yosef separated from Yaakov 22 years? Because Yosef was separated from age 17 to age 39. Because Yaakov was separated from his father Yitzchak for 22 years. 20 years in Laban's house and 2 years on the Derech. And because for those 22 years, Yaakov did not fulfill Kibud Avayim for Yitzchak, Yosef was separated from Yaakov, and he didn't yet keep with them. So if it was understood that this separation was supposed to be an onish for Yaakov, so, you know, Yosef had to go along with that idea. That's an interesting speculation. I don't know if we have a proof for that. But after all, eventually the beans were spilled anyway, right, years later. So if it would have happened earlier, it would have happened later. Presumably the same thing that did happen when it was revealed would have happened had it been revealed earlier. Yeah. Yes, but the question is, that's very true. Menashe means God has caused me to forget. So like this pshat, that would mean that I'm cut off. But there are many other explanations. In fact, there's a deep explanation which is worthy of a whole shir on its own, that in order to survive and adapt to a hostile environment, you have to almost forget where you came from. Because if you're totally connected to where you came from, you will never be able to survive where you are. So there is a concept of, on one hand, I need to remember the Musti Yukno, because that gives me strength. But I also need to know I'm in a new place. I think about this in terms of America. I can tell you, at the beginning of the 20th century, even in the 19th century, there were Rabbanim in America, largely unknown, who were Gedolei Torah Mamish, and they were in all sorts of crazy places, South Dakota, all sorts of places. Most of their children, in fact, almost 100% of their children, now the grandchildren are not religious. Many are not even Jewish anymore, with intermarriage. And the attitude these Rabbanim had, in many ways, I'm overgeneralizing, and again, I ask Mechila for the Niftarim, if I'm Pogeya, their Kavod. But they remembered Vilna, they remembered Brisk, they remembered Minsk, they remembered Belz, they remembered Ger. And they came to a place that was a desert, that was desolate, that was empty. And they knew they could never have a Vilna here, they could never have a Brisk here, they could never have a Mir here. The result it was that they really did not spend an investment in creating Jewish education. They created private, they would write Sfarim. There was no concept of even trying to have a day school because you couldn't replicate. Now, when you had the later Gedolim after World War II, Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Shraga Feilerman Lovitch, they had an idea that, okay, America is not going to be Brisk. America will not be Vilna.
But America can be America. Meaning to say, you have, well, what's the saying? I've mentioned it a lot. The best is often the enemy of the better. The idea that if you can't make something perfect, you don't go and do anything. When in fact, you could have still made it better. So that, I think, is the very deep idea that Yosef couldn't, as it were, totally be connected to the environment of Yaakov, because that was not possible to recreate in Mitzrayim. And therefore Yosef had to understand, I got to forget what I had there and try to create something here. That's a very typical challenge. So that means remembering the past also requires a certain measure of distancing from the past, because then you can deal with new challenges. Well, it's hard to understand all of this. I mean, basically, the brothers imposed an oath, even on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what that means, Chayim, and therefore Yitzchak could not reveal it. But again, I think it'll come back to what I'm going to say about why this whole process took place. So, yeah. Yes. That's what I'm saying.
It's a balance.
That's 100% correct. When Yosef said, named his son Menashe, God has made me forget, it doesn't mean total forgetting. It means, this is what's so complicated, there is a simultaneous process of remembering as a source of inspiration and chizuk and courage, but also forgetting, meaning my job is not to live in Vilna, because I'm not going to make Mitzrayim into Vilna, and if my image is, it has to be Vilna or bust, Vilna or zero, I'm always going to wind up with zero. So instead, I got to realize that if I'm not going to have Vilna, I'll have half of Vilna. And half of Vilna is better than no Vilna. Yeah, that would be a very, very logical approach, that Yosef understood that there was a reason why he was sold. Perhaps he didn't fully understand why, and therefore this had to be this particular way. Okay, so now this is what I want to get into. In other words, let's now analyze Yosef's behavior. I'll get to it.
Yeah. Why?
Well, when I left the question, you know, the shiur is not over yet. Okay, I will answer that. Hopefully, I'll give some answer to the question. So here, why is he so cruel to his brothers? Why does he want Binyamin, etc.? So there are two basic approaches in the Mefarshim. Approach number one is Ramban, and Ramban is probably the most familiar shita. That is, Yosef remembers the dreams that he had when he was 17 years old. And in those dreams, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bow down to him, treat him as a melech. He has another dream about the sheaves of grain. So says the Ramban, Yosef sees his dreams as a divine message, which indeed they are, that he is to be king of his brothers. So as a result, when the 10 brothers come and they bow down, that's wonderful. But it's only 10. There's one brother that hasn't come down yet. The dream has not been fulfilled. If Yosef reveals himself, then he's not going to be treated as king anymore. So he has to bring Binyamin down without Binyamin knowing. Now what about the Gavia? So here is what the Ramban says. Yosef had one more step. Because in the dream of the sun has to bow down to him as well. That means Yaakov. So the Ramban says, Yosef's strategy was, he would take Binyamin as a prisoner, and Yaakov would come down and beg for Binyamin with his wife Bilhah. The moon is not Yosef's own mother, Rachel, because Rachel is not alive, but Bilhah was his adopted mother. Which means, the Ramban actually says, and that actually fits Rabbeinu Bechaya, Mana Rach Yosef Chaima, that Yosef broke down prematurely. Yosef did not intend to reveal himself at that point, the Ramban says. Yosef's intention was to take Binyamin prisoner, and then Yaakov would come, and Yaakov, together with Bilhah, would bow down to him and then he would reveal, and this would be a kiyum of his halamos. But what happened was, manerach, Yashiv Chayma, Yehuda's response softened Yosef's heart. He couldn't hold himself back. This is Ramban. Abarbanel, the famous finance minister of Spain in the days of Ferdinand and Isabella, who financed the Columbus expeditions, but one of the great Mefarshim on Torah and Nach. No, it's a little joke. I don't have a lot of time. I don't want to spend too much time just telling you a joke, but they tell you Abarbanel's shita in Parshanut is he will often ask many, many questions. He'll ask like 50 questions on a parsha and then go over an explanation. So they say the story that this is dangerous. There was a fellow, right, who would read the Abarbanel after Cholent or whatever it is, and he would fall asleep before he read the answers. So he became an apikoros. He says, so many contradictions in the Torah. How can I believe in the Torah? You know, there's so many questions, right? So you got to be careful not to ask too many questions before you give some of the answers. But the Abarbanel asks the kasha. The Abarbanel brings the Ramban. And the Abarbanel asks the kasha on the Ramban. And the Abarbanel says, why is it Yosef's business? Yes, there's a dream, there's a prophecy. It's not a mitzvah. Hashem didn't command Yosef, make yourself a king. Hashem is telling Yosef, you're going to be a king and everyone's going to bow down to you. But do the ends justify the means? Does Yosef have the right to inflict pain on Yaakov, inflict pain on Binyamin because of his dream? Even if you assume, the Abarbanel says, that his dreams are prophecies from God. Prophecies are not mitzvahs. If I have a prophecy that I'm going to become a king, that doesn't mean I start giving people orders right now. It'll happen when it happens. And Hashem determines when it's going to happen. That's not a hedger for Yosef to do what he does. So the Abarbanel's own teres, the Rebbe is a different mahalach. The Abarbanel says that Yosef wants to ensure that his brothers have done tshuva for the chet of his sale. And the brothers hated Yosef initially because of the favoritism that Yaakov had shown Rachel over Leah, and that he showed the child of Rachel over Leah. And even though they had a cheshbon of rodef, like the Sephorno said, but there was jealousy, there was animosity, there was sinas chinam, and Yosef wanted to be sure that the brothers have overcome that hatred and jealousy. And his plan is, he takes the last, or the only, as far as they know, the only surviving child of Yaakov's favorite wife, and he's going to take them as a prisoner and see what the brother's reaction is. If the brother's reaction is, good riddance, at least now we don't have any Rachel children to bother us, then Yosef knows that they still have the taint of Sinah and Kinah. If, on the other hand, they are willing to give up their own lives and their own freedom for the child of Rachel, then they have overcome and they have done tshuva. So the whole idea of the Gavia, says the Abarbanel, was to test the brothers to see if they have done tshuva. Now, this is the end of the Abarbanel. So I just want to say that could you not ask on the Abarbanel the same question that the Abarbanel asks on the Ramban? And that is, okay, these brothers did something bad. But is it Yosef's business to make them do tshuva, especially if in that process he is hurting Yaakov and he is hurting Binyamin? What gives Yosef the right to manipulate reality, engage in fraud, deception, false accusations, false imprisonment, doing something that, you know, Yehuda told him could kill our father? Right, what's going on? So here I would just want to supplement the Abarbanel with the following thoughts. Yosef looks at his life, and Yosef sees a life which is extraordinarily miraculous in so many ways. The fact that he got sold is a miracle, albeit maybe a negative miracle. The fact that he was a slave languishing in prison for for more than 10 years, who somehow becomes the most powerful person in the world. I mean, he's under Pharaoh technically, but Yosef is running this country, which was a world empire. And Yosef understands there must be a reason. And the reason he understands is this. Hashem already told Avram that his children will be slaves in a land that is not theirs. Now, it didn't say Mitzrayim then. And they actually didn't know what country that would be. But Yosef understands that he is the precursor to the beginning of an exile. And Yaakov knows this too. That's why Yaakov is so afraid to come to Mitzrayim. And Hashem has to tell him, don't be afraid. Because Yaakov knows this is the beginning of Golas Mitzrayim. And Yosef sees his mission in life to give the Jewish people the survival skills to be able to get out of Mitzrayim. Huh? So what? Let me finish. I don't know why people are not letting me talk today. Okay. Yeah. I'm in the middle of something. All right. So here's the thing. The Jewish people were in Mitzrayim for 210 years. In those 210 years, we reached a very low level. We are in the 49th level of impurity. We were Ovdei Avodah Zarah Mamish. We were idol worshippers, except for Shevet Levi. We did not practice circumcision, except for Shevet Levi. We were in such a low spiritual state that, number one, four-fifths of the Jewish people didn't even make it. The one-fifth that survived, they were in the 49th level of Tumah, and the Arizal actually says that when it says they didn't have time to let their dough rise and they had to bake it as matzah, it doesn't just mean Paro was kicking us out. It means in those few minutes, we would have hit the 50. I don't even know what that means. The few minutes that it takes for dough to rise and become bread, we would have hit level 50. How did we survive? We were broken. We were crushed. We were decimated. Physically, in numbers, we lost four-fifths. Spiritually, we were over the Avodah Zarah. So Chazal say that the Jewish people had certain merits. And the lists vary from source to source, but commonly it says we didn't change our names, we didn't change our language, we wore distinctively Jewish clothing, whatever that would be, we didn't intermarry with non-Jews, we were faithful to our spouses, we didn't speak Lashon Hara against each other, meaning we didn't try to get advantages. Now, these are not indicia of frumkeit. It's not that they were frum, because if you're an idol worshiper, you're not doing it to serve God. These are what you might call pejoratively ethnic identification. Now, you might say, I mean, look, consider Israel, right? You have some chiloni Israeli who's in a discotheque or whatever, a bar. I don't know if they have, do they have discotheques today? I don't know, it's an old term, but... and, you know, he has his shirt open till his, belly button, and he's wearing a Magen David, and he goes by the name Rafi. Didn't change his name. Wearing a distinctive piece of Jewish jewelry. Magen David. Doesn't keep Shabbos, doesn't keep Kashrus, doesn't have any desire to do that. That counts for something? Well, the short answer, it does. Because what this says is, although the purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim was to receive Hashem's Torah, the root that enables redemption is identification with the Jewish people. You are my people. I want to be part of you. I care about you. I rejoice in your simchas. I feel the pain of your suffering. If you have identification with Am Yisrael, you are potentially a redeemable person. You may sink down to the 49th level, but that will keep you from the 50th level. You know, when I used to live in Chicago there's a street, Devon Avenue. Some of you who know that in Chicago know that. And Devon Avenue used to be 100% Jewish street. Now it's probably 80% Indian. Still some Jewish presence there. So I remember years ago, like 1980, So Devon Avenue had a non-kosher but kosher style restaurant called The Bagel, which was open on Shabbos. And I remember walking by and I saw a sign on Shabbos, and the sign said, "We serve you get a free glass of wine for every order of chobot." So I was thinking to myself, this is what is wrong. I mean, I was a young person then. This is what is wrong with American Jewry. This is gastronomic Jewry. Somebody, drinks treif wine, unless it's Megosho, treif wine with treif cholent, going into a restaurant on Shabbos, paying money, and thinks, I'm a Jew because I'm eating cholent, and Bubby used to make this thing called cholent, and Manischewitz wine, really good. And there's no connection to Hashem, no connection to mitzvos, no connection to Torah. What is that? But then, as I got older, hopefully wiser, you never know, I said, that does mean something. Because the person is saying, I don't know what Judaism is, I don't know what religion is, I don't know anything about this stuff, but I want to connect myself as a Jewish person, one way or the other. And that's exactly what happened in Mitzrayim. The idea that we're worshiping idols, we're not keeping anything, but you're my people. I think I've mentioned before, sometimes people go over to you in an airport or whatever, and if they see that you're conspicuously Orthodox or Jewish, they whisper sometimes, conspiratorially, "I'm a Jew too. I'm a member of the tribe." That's the phrase they like to use. And I have to admit, it irritates me because I don't like to be interrupted. But I wish it didn't irritate me, because it actually is a very good thing, and it's a very nice thing that somebody says, "I don't know what you're doing. I don't keep what you're doing. I have no idea why you're putting on those black boxes on top of your head, or why you have to get that special airline food that doesn't look so good, looks worse than the other airline food. But I just want you to know, I'm on your team. I'm with you." And that's a beautiful thing. So now, here's the thing. If Yosef sees as his role that he has to prepare the Jewish people to survive Golos Mitzrayim, and if indeed the only way we will survive Golos Mitzrayim is through a sense of unity and care for each other, then Yosef cannot let... See, when the brothers come to Mitzrayim, that's the beginning of the exile. That's the green light for Mitzrayim to begin. But Yosef will not allow, or cannot allow, because that's the mission that God gave him. He cannot allow the exile to begin until you have what is called the refuah before the makkah. So if this just would have been a situation where 10 individual people hurt me a lot and they got into tshuva, then it really wouldn't have been my business to manipulate things so they do tshuva. That's what Team Demon done. But this is not a question of rectifying what 10 people did. This is a question of creating a pattern that will enable us to survive in Mitzrayim and not hit the 50th level of Tumah that would totally destroy us. And that required unity, togetherness, love, care, concern. Yosef cannot allow the Golos to begin if his brothers are still tainted by the hatred that they had. And therefore, Yosef actually was able to manipulate things to be sure that the brothers have transcended that hatred. And then Yosef says, "Let the exile begin." Because now we have the refuah, we have the medicine that will keep them alive, albeit at a big cost, 49th level of tumor slipping. But this will keep them on life support. And by being kept on this life support, we will be able to emerge. Now the emphasis is, we know Chazal tell us, based on the book of Daniel, that there are 4 exiles. That's Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Edom, the Roman exile. And then Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer adds that before Mashiach there'll be a 5th aspect, and that's Yishmael. and Yisrael will combine with Esav, etc. And that's kind of, by the way, the Maral brings other midrashim. Yisrael will combine with Paras, which is very intriguing. Paras is Persia. Persia is Iran, which means there will be an Arab Iran, because Iranians are not Arabs, they're Muslims, but they're not Arabs, so they're Paras. So the Maral's point about Paras and Yishmael being Mechober is very scary, because it is mamash, the situation. So Mitzrayim is not. Mitzrayim is treated as a pre-Golus, because we were not yet in the land with the Torah, meaning to say. So Mitzrayim is not one of the four exiles. Mitzrayim, however, is the prototype of the exile. The Ramban, I'm sorry, the Vilna Gaon writes that everything that happened in Mitzrayim in various ways is a predictor of what we will go through in all of the different exiles. And therefore the idea is, just as we were redeemed from Mitzrayim only because of the Achdus and the unity that we had, so too we know that the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam, and we will only have a redemption if we can override that. Rav Kook used to say Avas Chinam, but okay. But the truth is, some want to say, they think Rav Kook didn't say that, and I'll tell you why. Because it's not in his writings. People say it bal peh. They say Rav Kook would never call Avas Yisrael Avas Chinam. It's very important to pay attention to this. Because Avas Chinam implies that person does not deserve my love, but I'll love him even though he's a piece of garbage. Rav Kook's Hashkafa was very much the opposite. I don't love this person because even though he's worthless, I love him. I love him because I see his value and I see his worth. So I think there's some strong point that Rav Kook would not have expressed the idea of Avas Chinam, because Avas Chinam in some ways is a patronizing phrase. Even though it's a beautiful phrase in some ways, it's also a little bit insulting. I love you, you know. Even sometimes I hear this sometimes with people say, people embrace Mechalel Beis Shabbos and say, I love you even though there's no reason to, but you know, I love you. Okay, you know. No, they're not.
What are they?
They're Persians. I mean, they're Persians. Persians are not Arabs. Arabs are from Yishmael. Persia is from Yefes. It's a different Yichas. So they are non-Arab Muslims. So when the Maral talks about the chibor between Paras and Yishmael, this is exactly the connection between the Iran and Arabs. Well, the end is Geula, but he says there'll be an awful destruction. He does say that. In fact, we know with the assassination of that general, Be'ezus Hashem, we should pray for Sholom. But it's a fairly dangerous situation right now. And as always, Ein Lanu Lihishaen, Ela Alavinu Shabbat Shemayim.